Side 14.
GP. I hadn't seen him for 2 months, more than 2 months. Being in France and Spain and then at home, I did try to see him twice, but he was away all September. There was a postcard in answer to my letters. That was all. I telephoned him and asked him if I could go round. The first evening I was back with Caroline. He said the next day there were some people there that evening. He seemed glad to see me. I was trying to look as if I hadn't tried to look pretty. I had. And I told him all about France and Spain and the Goyas and Albi and everything else, Piers. And he listened. He wouldn't really say what he'd been doing, but later he showed me some of the things he'd done in the Hebrides. And I felt ashamed. Because we'd none of us done much. We'd been too busy lying in the sun, I mean too lazy, and looking at great pictures to do much drawing or anything. I said, having gushed for at least an hour, I'm talking too much. He said, I don't mind. He was getting the rust off an old iron wheel with some acid. He'd seen it in a junk shop in Edinburgh and brought it all the way down. It had strange, obtuse teeth. He thought it was part of an old church clock. Very elegant, tapered spoke arms. It was beautiful. We didn't say anything for a while. I was leaning beside him against his bench, watching him clean off the rust. And then he said, I've missed you. I said, you can't have. He said, you've disturbed me. I said, knight to cover his pawn. Have you seen Antoinette? He said, no. I thought I told you I gave her the boot. He looked sideways, his lizard look. Still shocked, I shook my head. Forgiven? I said, there was nothing to forgive. He said, I kept on thinking about you in the Hebrides. I wanted to show you things. I said, I wished you were with us in Spain. He was busy, emery papering between the teeth. He said, it's very old. Look at this corrosion. And then in the same tone, in fact, I decided that I want to marry you. I didn't say anything, and I wouldn't look at him. He said, I asked you to come here when I was alone because I've been thinking quite hard about this. I'm twice your age. I ought to take things like this in my stride. Christ only knows it's not the first time. No, let me finish now. I've decided I've got to stop seeing you. I was going to tell you that when you came in. I can't go on being disturbed by you. I shall be if you keep on coming here. This isn't a roundabout way of asking you to marry me, and to make it quite impossible. You know what I am. You know I'm old enough to be your father. I'm not reliable at all. Anyhow, you don't love me. I said, I can't explain it. There isn't a word for it.
Precisely,
he answered. He was cleaning his hands with petrol, very clinical and matter-of-fact. So, I have to ask you to leave me to find my peace again. I stared at his hands. I was shocked. He said, in some ways, you're older than I am. You've never been deeply in love. Perhaps you never will be. He said, love goes on happening to you, to men. Oh, you become 20 again. You suffer as 20 suffers. All the dotty irrationalities of 20. I may seem very reasonable at the moment, but I don't feel it. When you telephoned, I nearly peed in my pants of excitement. I'm an old man in love. Stock comedy figure. Very stale. Not even funny. Why do you think I'll never be deeply in love? I said. He took a terribly long time to clean his hands. He said, I said, perhaps. I'm only just 20. He said, an ash tree a foot high is still an ash tree. But I did say perhaps. And you're not old. It's nothing to do with our ages. He gave me a faintly hurt look then, smiled and said, you must leave me some loophole. We went to make coffee, the wretched little kitchen, and I thought, anyhow, I couldn't face up to living here with him. Just the domestic effort. A vile, irrelevant wave of bourgeois cowardice. He said with his back to me, "Until you went away, I thought it was just the usual thing. At least I tried to think it was. That's why I misbehaved myself with your Swedish friend. To exercise you. But you came back, in my mind, again and again up north. I used to go out of the farmhouse at night into the garden. Look south. You do understand?" "Yes," I said. "It was you, you see. Not just the other thing." And then he said, "Oh, it's a sudden look you have. When you're not a kid anymore." "What sort of look?" "The woman will be," he said.
"A nice woman?"
"A much more than nice woman."
There's no word to say how he said it. Sadly, almost unwillingly. Tenderly, but a shade bitterly. And honestly, not teasing, not being dry, but right out of his real self.
I'd been looking down all the time we were talking, but he made me look up then. And our eyes met. And I know something passed between us. I could feel it, almost a physical touch, changing us. His saying something he totally meant, and my feeling it. He remained staring at me, so that I was embarrassed, and still he stared. I said, "Please, don't stare at me like that." He came and put his arm round my shoulders then, and led me gently towards the door. He said, "You're very pretty, at times. You're beautiful. You're sensitive, you're eager, you try to be honest. You manage to be both your age and natural and a little priggish and old-fashioned at the same time. You even play chess quite well. You're just the daughter I'd like to have. That's probably why I've wanted you so much these last few months." He pushed me through the door, face forward so I couldn't see him. "I can't say such things to you without turning your head."
"And you mustn't turn your head in any sense.
Now, go." I felt him press my shoulders an instant. And he kissed the back of my head, pushed me away. And I went 2 or 3 steps down the stairs before I stopped and looked back. He was smiling, but it was a sad smile. I said, "Please don't let it be too long." He just shook his head. I don't know if he meant, "No, not too long," or, "It's no good hoping it'll be anything else but very long." Perhaps he didn't know himself, but he looked sad. He looked sad all through. Of course, I looked sad, but I didn't really feel sad. Or it wasn't a sadness that hurt, not an all-through one. I rather enjoyed it, beastly, but I did. I sang on the way home. The romance, the mystery of it. Living. I thought I knew I didn't love him. I'd won that game. And what has happened since? That first day or two, I kept on thinking he would telephone, that it was all a sort of whim. Then I would think, I shan't see him again for months, perhaps years, and it seemed ridiculous, unnecessary, stupid beyond belief. I hated what seemed his weakness. I thought, oh, if he's like this, to hell with him. That didn't last very long. I decided to decide that it was for the best. He was right. It was best to make a clean break. I would concentrate on work, be practical and efficient, and everything that I'm not really by nature. All that time I kept thinking, do I love him? Then, obviously, there was so much doubt, I couldn't. And now, I have to write down what I feel now. Because I've changed again. I know it. I feel it. Looks. I know it's idiotically wrong to have preconceived notions about looks. Getting excited when Piers kisses me. Having to stare at him sometimes, not when he would notice because of his vanity, but feeling his looks intensely. Like a beautiful drawing of something ugly. You forget about the ugliness. I know Piers is morally and psychologically ugly. Just plain and dull, phony.
that even there I've changed. I think about GP holding me and caressing me. There's a sort of nasty, perverted curiosity in me. I mean, all the women he's had and all the things he must know about being in bed. I can imagine his making love to me, and it doesn't disgust me. Very expert and gentle. Fun. All sorts of things. But not the thing. If it's to be for life. Then there's his weakness. The feeling that he would probably betray me. And I've always thought of marriage as a sort of young adventure. Two people of the same age getting out together, discovering together, growing together. But I would have nothing to tell him. Nothing to show him. All the helping would be on his side. I've seen so little of the world. I know that GP in many ways represents a sort of ideal now. His sense of what counts. His independence, his refusal to do what the others do. His standing apart. It has to be someone with those qualities. And no one else I've met has them as he has. People at the Slade seem to have them, but they're so young. It's easy to be frank and to hell with convention when you're our age. Once or twice I've wondered whether it wasn't all a trap. Like a sacrifice in chess, supposing I'd said on the stairs, "Do what you like with me, but don't send me away." No, I won't believe that of him. Time lag. 2 years ago, I couldn't have dreamed of falling in love with an older man. I was always the one who argued for equal ages at Ladymont. I remembered being one of the most disgusted when Susan Grillet married a beastly baronet nearly three times her age. Minnie and I used to talk about guarding against being father types, because of M, and marrying father husbands. But now, I think I need a man older than myself because I always seem to see through the boys I meet. And I don't feel GP as a father husband. It's no good. I could go on writing arguments for and against all night. Emma, the business of being between inexperienced girl and experienced woman, the awful problem of the man. Caliban is Mr. Elton. Piers is Frank Churchill. But is GP Mr. Knightley? Of course, GP has lived a life and has views that would make Mr. Knightley turn in his grave. But Mr. Knightley could never have been a phony, because he was a hater of pretense, selfishness, snobbism. And they both have the one man's name I really can't stand. George. Perhaps there's a moral in that. November 18th. I've eaten nothing for 5 days. I've drunk some water. He brings me food, but I've touched not one crumb. Tomorrow, I'm going to start eating again. About half an hour ago, I stood up and I felt faint. I had to sit down again. I haven't felt ill so far. Just tummy pains and a bit weak. But this was something different. A warning. I'm not going to die for him. I haven't needed food. I've been so full of hatred for him and his beastliness. His vile cowardice. His selfishness. His Calibanity. November 19th. For all that time, I didn't want to write. Sometimes I wanted to. Then it seemed weak, like accepting things. I knew as soon as I wrote it down I'd go off the boil. But now I think it needs writing down, recording. He did this to me. Outrage! What little friendship, humanity, good nature there was between us has gone. From now on, we're enemies, both ways. He said things that showed he hates me as well. He resents my existence, that's exactly it. He doesn't realize fully it, because he's trying to be nice to me at the moment, but he's much nearer than he was. One day soon, he's going to wake up and say to himself, "I hate her." Something nasty. When I came round from the chloroform, I was in bed. I had my last underclothes on, but he must have taken everything else off.
I was furious that first night, mad with disgust, his beastly gloating hands touching me, peeling my stockings off. Loathsome. Then I thought of what he might have done, and hadn't. I decided not to fly at him, but silence. To shout at someone suggests that there's still contact. Since then, I've thought two things. First, he'd weird enough to have undressed me without thinking, according to some mad notion of the proper thing to do. Perhaps he thought I couldn't lie in bed with my clothes on. And then, that perhaps it was a sort of reminder of all the things he might have done but hadn't. His chivalry. And I accept that. I've been lucky. But I even find it frightening that he didn't do anything. What is he? There's a great rift between us now. It can never be bridged. He says now he will release me in another 4 weeks. Just talk. I don't believe him. So I've warned him I'm going to try to kill him. I would now. I wouldn't think twice about it. I've seen how Rob was before. How blind. I prostituted myself to Caliban. I mean, I let him spend all that money on me, and although I told myself it was fair, it wasn't, because I felt vaguely grateful. I'd been nice to him. Even my teasing was nice, even my sneering and spitting at him, even my breaking things, because it takes notice of him. And my attitude should have been what it will be from now on. Ice. Freeze him to death. He's absolutely inferior to me in all ways. His one superiority is his ability to keep me here. That's the only power he has. He can't behave, or think, or speak, or do anything else better than I can, nearly as well as I can. So he's going to be the old man of the sea until I shake him off somehow. It'll have to be by force. I've been sitting here and thinking about God. I don't think I believe in God anymore. It's not only me. I think of all the millions who must have lived like this in the war. The Anne Franks. And back through history. What I feel I know now is that God doesn't intervene. He lets us suffer. If you pray for liberty, then you may get relief just because you pray, or because things happen anyhow which bring you liberty. But God can't hear. There's nothing human like hearing, or seeing, or pitying, or helping about him. I mean, perhaps God has created the world and the fundamental laws of matter and evolution, but he can't care about the individuals. He's planned it so some individuals are happy, some sad, some lucky, some not. Who is sad? Who is not? He doesn't know, and he doesn't care. So he doesn't exist, really. These last few days I felt godless. I felt cleaner, less muddled, less blind. I still believe in a God, but he's so remote, so cold, so mathematical. I see that we have to live as if there is no God. Prayer and worship and singing hymns, all silly and useless. I'm trying to explain why I'm breaking with my principles about never committing violence. It is still my principle, but I see you have to break principles sometimes to survive. It's no good trusting vaguely in your luck, in providence, or God's being kind to you. You have to act and fight for yourself. The sky is absolutely empty. Beautifully pure and empty. As if the architects and builders would live in all the houses they built. Or could live in them all. It's obvious. It stares you in the face. There must be a God, and he can't know anything about us. Same evening. I've been very mean with him all day. Several times he's tried to speak, but I've shut him up. Did I want him to bring me anything? I said, I want nothing. I'm your prisoner. If you give me food, I shall eat it to keep alive. Our relations from now on, strictly those of a prisoner and a warder. Now please, leave me alone. Luckily, I've plenty to read. He'll go on bringing me cigarettes, and if he doesn't, I shan't ask him for them. And food. That's all I want from him. He's not human. He's an empty space, disguised as a human.
November 20th. I'm making him wish he never set eyes on me. He brought in some baked beans for lunch. I was reading on the bed. He stood for a moment and then started to go out. I jumped to the table, picked up the plate and hurled it at him.
I don't like baked beans.
He knows it. I suppose he'd been lazy. I wasn't in a temper. I just pretended. He stood there with the filthy little bits of orange sauce on his so-clean clothes and looked sheepish. "I don't want any lunch," I snapped him, and turned my back. I ate chocolates all the afternoon. He didn't reappear until supper time. There was caviar and smoked salmon and cold chicken. He buys them ready cooked somewhere. All things he knows I like. And a dozen other things he knows I like, the cunning brute. It's not the buying them that's cunning. It's just that I can't help being grateful. I didn't actually say I was grateful, but I wasn't sharp. It's that he presents them so humbly, with such an air of, please don't thank me, and I deserve it all. When he was arranging my supper things on the table, I had an irresistible desire to giggle. Awful. I wanted to collapse on the bed and scream. He was so perfectly himself, and I am so cooped up. Down here my moods change so rapidly. All determination to do one thing one hour, all for another the next. It's no use. I'm not a hater by nature. It's as if somewhere in me a certain amount of goodwill and kindness is manufactured every day, and it must come out. If I bottle it up, then it bursts out. I wasn't nice to him. I don't want to be nice to him. I shan't be nice to him. But it was a struggle not to be ordinary to him. I mean little things like, that was a nice meal. As it was, I said nothing. And when he said, will that be all? Like a butler. I said, yes, you can go now. And turned my back. He would have got a shock if he could have seen my face. It was smiling. And when he shut the door, I was laughing. I couldn't help it again. Hysteria! Something I've been doing a lot these last days, staring at myself in the mirror. Sometimes I don't seem real to myself. It suddenly seems that it isn't my reflection only a foot or two away. I have to look aside. I look all over my face and my eyes. I try to see what my eyes say, what I am, why I'm here. It's because I'm so lonely. I have to look at an intelligent face. Anyone who's been locked away like this would understand. You become very real to yourself in a strange way, as you never were before. So much of you is given to ordinary people, suppressed in ordinary life. I watch my face, and I watch it move as if it's someone else's. I stare myself out. I sit with myself. Sometimes, it's like a sort of spell, and I have to put my tongue out and wrinkle my nose to break it. I sit down here in the absolute silence with my reflection in a sort of state of mystery, in a trance. November 21st. It's the middle of the night. I can't sleep. I hate myself. I nearly became a murderess tonight. I shall never be the same again. It's difficult to write. My hands are bound. I've got the gag off. It all began at lunch. I realized that I was having a struggle not to be nice to him, because I felt I must talk to someone, even him. At least he's a human being. When he went away after lunch, I wanted to call him back to talk. What I felt was quite different from what I decided I should feel 2 days ago, so I made a new decision. I could never hit him with anything down here. I've watched him so much with that in mind, and he never turns his back to me. Besides, there's no weapon. So I thought, I've got to get upstairs and find something, some means. I had several ideas. Otherwise, I was afraid I would fall into the old trap of pitying him. So I was a bit nicer at supper time, and said I needed a bath, which I did. He went away, came back, and we went up. And there, it seemed a sign, specially left for me, was a small axe. It was on the kitchen windowsill, which is next to the door. He must have been chopping wood outside and forgotten to hide it, my always being down here. We passed indoors too quickly for me to do anything then, but I lay in the bath and thought. I decided it must be done. I had to catch up the axe and hit him with the blunt end, knock him out. I hadn't the least idea where on the head was the best place to hit or how hard it had to be. Then I asked to go straight back. As we went out through the kitchen door,
I dropped my talcum powder and things and stood to one side towards the windowsill as if I was looking to see where they'd gone. He did just what I wanted and bent forward to pick them up. I wasn't nervous. I picked the axe up very neatly. I didn't scrape the blade, and it was the blunt end. But then, it was like waking up out of a bad dream. I had to hit him, and I couldn't. But I had to. Then he began to straighten up. All this happened in a flash, really, and I did hit him. But he was turning, and I didn't hit straight. Or hard enough. I mean, I lashed out in a panic at the last moment. He fell sideways. But I knew he wasn't knocked out. He still kept hold of me. I suddenly felt I had to kill him, or he would kill me. I hit him again, but he had his arm up. At the same time, he kicked out and knocked me off my feet. It was too horrible. Panting, straining like animals. And suddenly I knew it. I don't know. Undignified. It sounds absurd, but that was it. Like a statue lying on its side. Like a fat woman trying to get up off the grass. We got up. He pushed me roughly towards the door, keeping a tight hold of me. But that was all. I had a funny feeling it was the same for him. Disgusting. I thought someone may have heard, even though I couldn't call out, but it was windy. Wet and cold. No one would have been out. I'd been lying on the bed. I soon stopped crying. I'd been lying for hours in the dark and thinking. November 22nd. I'm ashamed. I let myself down vilely. I've come to a series of decisions, thoughts. Violence and force are wrong. If I use violence, I descend to his level. It means that I have no real belief in the power of reason and sympathy and humanity. That I lame duck people only because it flatters me, not because I believe they need my sympathy. I've been thinking back to Ladymont, to people I lame ducked there. Sally Margeson. I lame-ducked her just to show the Vestal Virgins that I was cleverer than they. That I could get her to do things for me that she wouldn't do for them. Donald and Piers. Because I've lame-ducked him in a sense, too. But they're both attractive young men. There were probably hundreds of other people who needed lame-ducking my sympathy far more than those two. And anyway, most girls would have jumped at the chance of lame-ducking them. I've given up too soon with Caliban. I've got to take up a new attitude with him. The prisoner-warder idea was silly. I won't spit at him anymore. I'll be silent when he irritates me. I'll treat him as someone who needs all my sympathy and understanding. I'll go on trying to teach him things about art. Other things. There's only one way to do things. The right way. Not what they meant by the right way at Ladymont. But the way you feel is right. My own right way. I am a moral person. I'm not ashamed of being moral. I will not let Caliban make me immoral. Even though he deserves all my hatred and bitterness and an axe in his head. Later. I've been nice to him. That is, not the cat I've been lately. As soon as he came in, I made him let me look at his head, and I dabbed some Dettol on it. He was nervous. I make him jumpy. He doesn't trust me. That is precisely the state I shouldn't have got him into. It's difficult, though. When I'm being beastly to him, he has such a way of looking sorry for himself that I begin to hate myself. But as soon as I begin to be nice to him, a sort of self-satisfaction seems to creep into his voice and his manner. Very discreet, he's been humility itself all day. No reproach about last night, of course. And I begin to want to goad and slap him again. A tightrope. But it's cleared the air. Night. I tried to teach him what to look for in abstract art after supper. It's hopeless. He has it fixed in his poor dim noddle that art is fiddling away. He can't understand why I don't rub out. until you get an exact photographic likeness, and that making lovely, cool designs, Ben Nicholson, is vaguely immoral. I can see it makes a nice pattern, he said. But he won't concede that making a nice pattern is art. With him, it's that certain words have terribly strong undertones. Everything to do with art embarrasses him, and I suppose fascinates him. It's all vaguely immoral. He knows great art is great, but great means locked away in museums and spoken about when you want to show off. Living art, modern art, shocks him. You can't talk about it with him because the word art starts off a whole series of shocked, guilty ideas in him. I wish I knew if there were many people like him. Of course, I know the vast majority, especially the new people, don't care a damn about any of the arts. But is it because they are like him? Or because they just couldn't care less? I mean, does it really bore them? So that they don't need it at all in their lives? Or does it secretly shock and dismay them, so that they have to pretend to be bored? November 23rd. I'd just finished Saturday night and Sunday morning. Oh, it shocked me. It shocked me in itself, and it shocked me because of where I am. It shocked me in the same way as Room at the Top shocked me when I read it last year. I know they're very clever. It must be wonderful to be able to write like Alan Sillitoe. Real, unphony, saying what you mean. If he was a painter, it would be wonderful. He'd be like John Bradby, much better. He'd be able to set Nottingham down, and it would be wonderful in paint. Because he painted so well, put down what he saw, people would admire him. But it isn't enough to write well. I mean, choose the right words and so on to be a good writer. Because I think Saturday night and Sunday morning is disgusting. I think Arthur Seton is disgusting. And I think the most disgusting thing of all is that Alan Sillitoe doesn't show that he's disgusted by his young man. I think they think young men like that are really rather fine. I hated the way Arthur Seton just doesn't care about anything outside his own little life. He's mean, narrow, selfish, brutal. Because he's cheeky and hates his work and is successful with women, he's supposed to be vital. The only thing I like about him is the feeling that there is something there that could be used for good if it could be got at. It's the inwardness of such people. They're not caring what happens anywhere else in the world. In life. They're being in a box. Perhaps Alan Sillitoe wanted to attack the society that produces such people. But he doesn't make it clear. I know what he's done. He's fallen in love with what he's painting. He started out to paint it as ugly as it is, but then its ugliness conquered him and he started trying to cheat. To prettify. It shocked me too because of Caliban. I see there's something of Arthur Seton in him. Only in him, it's turned upside down. I mean, he has that hate of other things and other people outside his own type. He has that selfishness. It's not even an honest selfishness, because he puts the blame on life and then enjoys being selfish with a free conscience. He's obstinate, too. This has shocked me because I think everyone now, except us, and we're contaminated, has this selfishness and this brutality. Whether it's hidden, mousy and perverse, or obvious and crude. Religion's as good as dead. There's nothing to hold back the new people. They'll grow stronger and stronger and swamp us. No, they won't. Because of David. Because of people like Alan Sillitoe. It says on the back he was the son of a labourer. I mean, the intelligent new people will always revolt and come across to our side. The new people destroy themselves because they're so stupid. They can never keep the intelligent ones with them, especially the young ones. We want something better than just money and keeping up with the Joneses. But it's a battle. It's like being in a city and being besieged. They're all around. And we've got to hold out.
It's a battle between Caliban and myself. He is the new people, and I am the few. I must fight with my weapons, not his. Not selfishness and brutality and shame and resentment. He's worse than the Arthur Seton kind. If Arthur Seton saw a modern statue he didn't like, he'd smash it. But Caliban would drape a tarpaulin round it. I don't know which is worse. But I think Caliban's way is. November 24th. I'm getting desperate to escape. I can't get any relief from drawing or playing records or reading. The burning, burning need I have, all prisoners must have, is for other people. Caliban is only half a person at the best of times. I want to see dozens and dozens of strange faces. Like being terribly thirsty and gulping down glass after glass of water. Exactly like that. I read once that nobody can stand more than 10 years in prison, or more than 1 year of solitary confinement. One just can't imagine what prison is like from outside. You think, well, there'd be lots of time to think and read. It wouldn't be too bad. But it is too bad. It's the slowness of time. I'll swear all the clocks in the world have gone centuries slower since I came here. Oh, I shouldn't complain. This is a luxury prison. And there's his diabolical cunning about the newspapers and radio and so on. I never read the papers very much, or listened to the news. But to be totally cut off, it's so strange. I feel I've lost all my bearings. I spend hours lying on the bed, thinking about how to escape. Endless. November 25th. Afternoon. This morning, I had a talk with him. I got him to sit as a model. Then I asked him what he really wanted me to do. Should I become his mistress? But that shocked him. He went red and said he could buy that in London. I told him he was a Chinese box, and he is. The innermost box is that I should love him. In all ways. With my body. With my mind. Respect him and cherish him. It's so utterly impossible. Even if I could overcome the physical thing. How could I ever look in any way but down on him? Battering his head on a stone wall. I don't want to die. I feel full of endurance. I shall always want to survive. I will survive. November 26th. The only unusual thing about him. How he loves me. Ordinary new people couldn't love anything as he loves me. That is, blindly. Absolutely. Like Dante and Beatrice. He enjoys being hopelessly in love with me. I expect Dante was the same. Mooning around, knowing it was all quite hopeless, and getting lots of good creative material from the experience. Though, of course, Caliban can't get anything but his own miserable pleasure. People who don't make anything. I hate them. How frightened of dying I was in those first days. I don't want to die because I keep on thinking of the future. I'm desperately curious to know what life will bring to me. What will happen to me? How I'll develop, what I'll be in 5 years' time, in 10, in 30. The man I will marry and the places I will live in and get to know. Children. It isn't just a selfish curiosity. This is the worst possible time in history to die. Space travel. Science, the whole world waking up and stretching itself. A new age is beginning. I know it's dangerous, but it's wonderful to be alive in it. I love, I adore my age.
I keep on having thoughts today.
One was, uncreative men plus opportunity to create equals evil men. Another one was, killing him was breaking my word to what I believe. Some people would say, you're only a drop. Your word-breaking is only a drop. It wouldn't matter. But all the evil in the world's made up of little drops. It's silly talking about the unimportance of the little drops. The little drops and the ocean are the same thing.
End of side 14.